All right. So, yeah. All right, man. We are live. So, welcome everybody to the Bike James podcast. I'm here with my buddy Ryan Leach. Ryan, how's it going?
Hey, James. Great. Thanks.
Awesome. Awesome. So, really, this is kind of a not really a particular subject podcast. Ryan and I just like to get together and chat. And so, which is really kind of what a lot of our podcasts have been. So, anyways, yeah, we decided to get together and hit record and have a conversation and see what pops up. So, but yeah, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, Ryan, about your new, newest, you've been doing it for a while, your website. You know, you were over in Spain for a while, I guess. Yeah. Just kind of catch me up, man. Adventures and stuff lately.
Yeah. It was actually really, I've just been working so hard, logging so many hours, for my coaching website, and it was really nice just to get a change of pace going over to Europe for basically is like a 12-day camping road trip and riding in a bunch of different spots and filming. It's actually going to be a documentary. It'll be kind of a film festival piece on sort of the evolution of my riding, and one of the other a pro from Austria, Tom Oller, who's a Red Bull rider who's got a background in trials, and he's kind of transitioned to a lot of mountain bike style riding as well. So just a fun little exploration of how our careers have evolved from pure trials to mountain biking. Are you still there, James?
Yeah. Cut out for just a second, but it's all right. Technology, right? So that's interesting. I think I saw you post a video. Is he the guy who was like riding the switchbacks and just like all the ridiculous ways, like one he was like riding down it backwards or something? Like
totally.
Yeah.
He's like, he's magic on his front wheel. Like he's got some beautiful skills, and actually I did some tutorial stuff with him while I was over there, so that'll be a new project coming up for my coaching site. So
awesome. Yeah. No, those were some cool videos, and yeah, you post some cool stuff on Facebook quite often. So if people don't follow you, was it Ryan Leach on Facebook? Is that, or do you have like a page that you post to? Like, where would people find you online if they want?
It's Ryan Leach. I've got a personal page that I basically never use because I really don't really like doing social media stuff. It's just like such a chore. I don't know about you, but it's a tough thing for me. Some people are so natural, it seems, but it's always been a chore for me. I mean, it's part of my business, obviously, so I do, and there's often, it's more just like when I've got ideas and things that I want to share that can be useful, or if I'm doing promotion stuff, like I do a ton of promo kind of style stuff on Facebook, and so that's good. But beyond that, it's, I don't know, if I didn't have like a business or like a few ideas to share, I mean, I don't think I'd use social media really. I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny.
What about you?
No, I'm the same way, man. I mean, it's such a double-edged sword, right? It's like anything else, because social media obviously allows guys like you and me to communicate and interact with people in ways that just weren't possible beforehand. But by the same token, like you said, it can really start to be start to take over a big mental chunk of your life, because you start to see the world through social media, like, oh, I should have gotten a picture of that, or you know, I should video of this and post it to my page. And all of a sudden, you're not just living your life; you're like trying to create a social media story. And so, which is, again, like you said, some people are really natural at it, and that's great. But I actually recently took Instagram and Facebook and all that stuff off of my phone. And I, for the last couple of weeks, man, and I've never been like kind of happier or more relaxed. I won't say never, but it's definitely made an impact on my overall happiness level. So I'll go online when I'm on my computer, on my PC, but I had to get away from it being like, you know, on my phone. So no, I'm the exact same way, man. I'm the same way. I hear you.
Yeah, no, that's it's weird. I did like a 10-minute meditation this morning, and one of the things that popped up for me was I gotta take Facebook off my phone. So it's crazy you talk about that actually just right now. It's literally on my mind. So yeah, I might give that a go, man. It's cool to hear you did that. I'm definitely curious. But yeah, double-edged sword for sure, because it's incredible what this connected sort of social media world has enabled. But it's also just so important to stay conscious of some of the surfing and sort of browsing sort of habits and checking the phone habits that are just so, it's so powerful. I mean, they're wizards. Those companies, they are wizards at trying to get you to spend your time on their platforms.
Oh yeah, there's a book called Hooked, and it's written by a guy who is an app designer, and he explains exactly how they do it. He breaks it down. This is how we get you mentally addicted to these apps. Like, they're doing it consciously for sure.
I mean, it's a contest for time. And that's an interesting thing I've been contemplating about my online coaching business is, my goal is to inspire people to get out on their bikes and ride smart, and to practice intentionally while they're out riding. And I don't want to create an online experience that kind of is kind of holding them to the computer and to the screen. So I have to be careful about that and smart about how I sort of proceed, because it's about getting outside and riding your bike, really, in the end of the day. And so that's why I'm really being careful, because I'm spending way too much time on the computer, and I'm not necessarily living the example during the sort of this growth period of my online business. And I definitely feel the effects, and I don't want that to come through in the content that I create, because it will, I got a good place myself.
I hear you,
Be in a good
man.
balance.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm kind of going through the same. It's funny. We go through a lot of the same things, man. With my online business and the pedal's taken up a lot of time and energy and stuff. And so, I don't know, man. It's something I've recently had to kind of come to grips with and just make peace with. It's seasons of our life. Sounds like a fucking cheesy 70s song, but like, I'm just at a certain point, I just have to admit to myself, like, I needed to be the person, I needed to ride as much as I was riding, I needed to take my riding to the level so that I could see things in the way that would allow me, to come back from that peak and like share lessons and help people. But the reality is I'm not going to be able to physically, one, physically, and two, just is like life and stuff goes on, like, have the same type of energy and time to put into it to continue to maintain that peak. And it is like kind of an interesting deal, because you're like, well, this peak is what got me to this point. And
And you're talking about the riding, your
riding,
riding level.
like, just having your riding to that level where, so yeah, I hear you. But I think that it is definitely a balancing act between the two, because there is something to, like, if you're going to take the time to share your knowledge, you're not going to have the same amount of time to pour into your own personal, skills and fitness and stuff like that, but you don't want to go like the Greg Glassman route, the owner of CrossFit, who's now famously kind of fat and out of shape because he's like, gone so far, the other way. It's like, you definitely want to maintain a certain level, just out of respect for the art. But yeah, but anyways, that's just something, kind of me personally, the way that I've been looking at it. But yeah, I hear you, man. I got two kids now, and a lot of other things going on. So, I mean, I look back, I remember the day when I rode like 17 days in a row is like a personal fucking thing for me at that point. Keep this streak going, man. You know, every day,
yeah,
2 weeks hitting the trail. And like today, I'm like, dude, there's just no way I could pull that off. Like physically and time wise, I just couldn't do that. So,
yeah, yeah. Yes, no, you're right in terms of just how things do ebb and flow, because it's an illusion to think that there's one prime balance in work and play and family, you know, that can be maintained always.
Yeah, it's a myth.
Because, you know, we have different drives, we have different inspirations, and sometimes those inspirations can be all consuming and it's fantastic and it's awesome, and other parts of our lives need to fall to the side while we nurture this one sort of focus. And, you know, I think that's okay. I mean, I think that's so just sort of, really honoring what those trends are, but, just being conscious that, yeah, the other parts of life may suffer, and we can't just, get into a workaholic kind of pattern. We've got to just really stay on top of those possible sort of, trends that aren't healthy and break out when it's time to break out.
Yeah. That's what kind of circling back to taking Facebook off the phone. Cause it's like at a certain point, it isn't a matter of time. It's a matter of like, where is your time being focused? And, you know, if you're spending even 30 minutes a day, you know, throughout the day surfing around on social media, you know, that's like time and energy that, you know, so yeah, it's getting like very guarding your time very jealously. Have you ever read, On the Shortness of Life by Seneca, the Roman Stoic philosopher?
Is that what Tim Ferriss was going on about? Like,
yeah.
A year ago or something?
Yeah, more than likely. I know he's like into the Stoic philosophy stuff, and Seneca is one of the most popular guys. He's got a couple books, but he's got one on the shortness of life is the name of it, and highly recommend it, man. I recently reread it, but that's kind of the whole theme of the book is like, you know, when you look at how you spend your time, you know, how are you spending it, you know, like, or is it being spent on endeavors and things that, you know, you're going to look back on when you're old and be like, yeah, that was worth it. Or are you going to be like, what was I thinking? You know, kind of the modern day Fight Club kind of, you know, people are working jobs they hate for shit they don't need and realize that it's too late at the end. So, but that's actually reading that book is what inspired me to take the social media stuff off my phone, because it's a series of letters that he's writing to a guy, and I forget his name, but you know, one of the things he keeps pointing out, because like you remember in Rome, like their political system was the big deal, right? Like everybody's trying to move up in the world, and it's like, you know, you got to like find somebody's butt to kiss, and hopefully they're going to pull you up, and they're finding somebody's butt to kiss, and they're trying to get pulled up. And so everybody's got patrons that they're trying to, you know, keep happy. And then they've got people higher up that they're trying to keep their attention and hopefully have them pull them up. And I realized, like, dude, social media at its worst, that's what it gets turned into, is the modern day Roman political system, because you follow people that are higher up than you, you know, and you're liking their stuff and you're commenting because you're hoping to catch their attention and that they're somehow going to elevate you. And in the meantime, you're trying to collect patrons, people who follow you, and then you feel compelled to share things and do things for them because, you know, you need them, you know, needing you to show the people above you how important you know what I mean? And so it's this whole like, man, it just hit me like a ton of bricks when I was reading that. And I was like, holy crap. Like that's what.
So that's social media then.
Yep, that's what social media is turned, like at its worst. You know what I mean? Like again, I wanna make sure we social media, it's like most things, that it has positives, but it can turn very ugly. And at its ugliest, that's what I realized that it turns into. And I realized, I was kind of getting sucked into that mindset a little bit. So that's why I was like, I just got to get rid of this, man. So it,
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. Interesting
No,
stuff.
that's
Check out that book. It's a very interesting book. You'll dig it for sure.
Yeah, no, that's sounds cool. No, it was on my radar, but I never went down that rabbit hole. So,
Yeah.
it's kind of bringing it back to riding as well. It's like, just staying, stay, it's like this, I think kind of again, this illusion of balance. When we're on our bike and we're balancing, sometimes we think that we've got, oh, we're totally balanced, but really we're never in balance. We're constantly adjusting to maintain balance. Like there's never a perfect balance, and it takes skill to be able to so quickly be able to adjust, and so you can maintain that sort of illusion of balance. And I think that's kind of like, if you get distracted while you're riding a balance line, then you kind of lose your balance, you lose focus, you start thinking about something, then yeah, you'll lose your balance enough that you're gonna fail on the line. And I think that goes for a lot of these things. When we in social media, I think that's the razor's edge that you're kind of talking about. If you're kind of constantly sort of adjusting and correcting while spending time on the platform, you'll realize when the benefits start turning into sort of detriments. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and everybody's different, Like I've got an article I wrote on Strava, how like the first time I came back from a ride and I thought I had a good ride and I looked at my Strava time and was disappointed, I got rid of it. I was like, I don't want this. But some people can handle it, Other people are different. I think the real take home thing is like you need to be conscious of yourself and who you are, and what may work for one person may not work for you. And so, again, like we were saying, like some people are very natural at social media and handle it very well. And then guys like us look at it, and if you or I, as a round peg, try to shove ourselves into that square hole, that's where friction and discomfort and things come in our lives. And so, just being conscious of like, where, where that balance point is for you, because it's going to be different, for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, for sure. Well, kind of like, not like a perfect segue, but, I wanted to ask you about this, and it kind of touches on what we're talking about. Man, you sent out a really cool post today called Rebelling Against Risk. And I really liked what you were talking about with it. So why don't you just kind of explain real quick, like what that post was about and the inspiration for it?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it was on this trip to Europe that I really sort of caught on to the power of having when it's so for me, I've always taken big risks in my career, and I've generally pulled them off. I've done really well. Risk has served me well, and I've respected risk generally throughout my career. I've avoided injury to a large extent. So, really this post, like rebelling against risk, is not saying that risk is bad. I don't want to say that. I'm just saying that it's got to be, when you're taking a risk, you've got to be all in. You've got your body and your mind have to be in sync. They've got to both be on board in order to conquer the risk, in order to basically just make the riding line happen without getting injured. And you see that in the sort of the extreme sports world time and time again. People do incredible things and they land it, and it doesn't make any sense. but they're totally in sync. Their body, they're fully, their desire is true. It's authentic. They want to ride that line. And so I was really, on this last trip, I was really noticing just how powerful the effect is on my riding when my body and mind isn't in sync. So, you know, the momentum from my past filming excursions was okay to ride some really cool lines and create some really entertaining video footage. And I was noticing when I went to approach a line or think about doing a line, there was a lot of resistance. Like I didn't want to do it. And that created this disconnect between what my body I knew probably could do, but I didn't really, my mind was like, no, this is ridiculous. You shouldn't do this. And then, so that made my riding, when I did attempt a line, I felt really sketchy and it felt really dangerous. And, so that was like, wow, you know, this, you know, I think this is really comes down to, do you really, what is your desire? Are you really on board for learning this? And then if you are, then the risk is going to be worth it, even if you do crash. But if you're not on board, you don't think the risk, the apparent risk is worth it, then yeah, you shouldn't do it, shouldn't ride it. So I don't know, that was a long, long explanation there, a little more backstory to that post.
No, man, no, it's good. I mean, I think that it really struck home for me, because like I mentioned earlier, like one of the things I'm just realizing, like, I mean, again, like I never got to like, you know, super great pro level status, but, you know, I used to be able to ride some pretty big stuff. I mean, we had the ranch where they had the, you know, here in Grand Junction, they hosted, you know, the free ride mountain bike tour on it a couple years, and I mean, you know, like 40 foot gap jumps and, you know, freaking big overhead high wood lips shooting you straight up. I mean,
yeah,
super high consequences stuff. And
yeah.
You know, just at a certain point, it's weird, man. It's really weird. You hate to say it, because it's like I just recently turned 41, and I don't know if it's like, you know, there's something different. There's something that happens mentally at a certain point where all of a sudden your brain just does not perceive risk the same way that it did when I was in my 20s and early 30s. And I've been struggling with that same thing, like rolling up on lines that like 10 years ago I would have just freaking rolled through without ever thinking twice about, and finding my brain all of a sudden going like, dude, you know, if you went over the handlebars here, it would be really ugly. And all of a sudden, like once you think that, once that's in your head, it's like, fuck. Like, you know, trying to ride with that in the back of your mind gets harder and harder to do. And so, yeah, man.
Well, what's that fuck moment then?
What's that?
So you're just saying like, okay, I'm just going to, you roll up to the line and something you would have ridden no problem 10 years ago, and you roll up and you're like, fuck.
Yeah,
it's not. So what is that? Yeah, I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, man, honestly,
it's like it's some sort of defeated sort of. That's the thing. It feels like you're not up to snuff. You're not up to standard. Like it feels like a negative thing. So I think that needs to change.
Yes. It is. No, totally, man. I that is exactly it. Like that's the struggle. Is like. Being comfortable with that and letting yourself mentally change with that, because yeah, for sure. I don't know. I look at, I read a lot of history and stuff. Like right now I'm actually reading like the story of Xenophon and the 10,000 Greeks that got stuck in Persia and had to fucking walk their way out. If anyone ever wants to feel like, you know, hey, my life is sucks, like read that story and you know, your day will get a lot better. But man, like back in the day, like even the Romans, like if you looked at how they divided the troops, like at 20 years old, like those were the frontline troops. At 30 years old, they moved back in the line a little bit. At 40 years old, they were even further back. And it had to do with experience for one, but like honestly, you can't, at a certain point, like like our brains are chemistry, right? Like they're based on chemical reactions, and that chemistry changes as we age. There's just nothing you can do about that. And denying that, like you're supposed to look at risk differently when you're 25 than you do when you're 35 than you do when you're 45. And it's just, it's the way that we're programmed to age and how, and the process that we go through. And I think that really what it boils down to, man, like for guys like us, like at least we can look back and say, like, you know, you hate to sound like that old dude at the bar is like, oh, back in my day, I could do blah, blah, blah. But all of a sudden you're like, no, I kind of understand where that dude's coming from. You know, like it's, but at least he's got stories to fucking tell. There's a lot of people that don't have stories to tell, man. They hit this point, like they don't start mountain biking until their late 30s and early 40s. And
there's a lot of riders in that camp, for sure.
And they're looking at the 20-something year olds with their completely different view of risk and trying to ride like them and emulate them and not understanding that, man, you're on a different path than they are at this point. Like physically, mentally, things are different. So you need to be looking at a different path than those guys are gonna take. But also for guys like us that have freaking decades or more under their belt of riding, and you get to that point like we're talking about where all of a sudden the risk just starts to look different, man. And it's like, I guess just like at some point there's a fine line, right? Like you don't want to use it as an excuse to just be a wuss and just walk everything, but at a certain point,
yeah,
like, being comfortable and be like, man, you know what, it's okay, like it's okay, and it's safer for me to walk this than to try to force myself to ride it with that doubt in my mind. And
yeah,
so
yeah.
Anyways, yeah, man.
And it's a spectrum. It's a continuum too. You know, it risk is not, it's not like a line is risky or it's not. It's on a scale, and
it is.
And that's why, I mean, that's, you know, when mountain biking, you know, if you go mountain biking, there's risk no matter what. I mean,
yeah.
It's and so it's an interesting point though about that you say about how a lot of mountain bikers are getting into the sport later in life. And so, yeah, I mean, I just really feel for that demographic in terms of their, and I've spent time thinking about it too. And, you know, that's a big part of why I do what I do on my coaching site is, you know, having technical skills helps to make riding safer. Like for instance, you know, if you're coming to a tight downhill switchback, and I'm actually working on a 10 lesson series to add to the cornering continuum course that I just released, that addresses this specific kind of situation. And that's like a super tight switchback, and to ride it without adjusting your rear tire up and over to find a more friendly line, that's a challenging technical skill, but it makes that line way safer, and you can learn that rotating endo or nose pick in a fairly safe way, like a very gradual safe way to gain that skill, and then that will enable you to ride a line with much more confidence and in a safer way, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, that's a huge part. It's one of the things I try to explain to people all the time. Like I was getting, getting interviewed by a guy writing an article for Triathlete magazine. They're doing an article, for triathletes that want to get into mountain biking and like, you know, Xterra, like off-road races and stuff. And like that was one of the things I kept, you know, trying to emphasize is like you technical skills are so important. Like you cannot out fitness your way through bad skills on the trail. Like one from a performance standpoint is not going to work, and from a safety standpoint, you're just putting yourself at so much more risk. So yeah, man, the skills are such a huge aspect of it. I mean, yeah, it's so crazy. Win a downhill race without pedaling with a broken chain, and like the next day, all the downhillers just went right back to, you know, their freaking trainers and just pedaling their way. You know, it's like if there was ever such a stark, you know, example of how much not pedaling plays a role in your performance on a mountain bike, you know, that was it. And even if you're not a downhiller, most trails are at least 50% downhill, right? I mean, most of the time you end up where you started, and so you're gonna, you know, you're gonna be riding downhill. So every time the bike is pointing down, pedaling is not a factor. And at that point, it's all skill. And so if like 50% of the ride is downhill, and then even when you're not going downhill, you know, so anyways, I'm just trying to reinforce what you're saying for people who are listening to this.
Cool.
The technical skills are so important, so important. So yeah, like that's why, you know, I really love what you're doing with your site and how you're, you know, taking the time to, you know, share that knowledge, with people and the lessons that you've learned. And really one of the things that I appreciate, I haven't like, you know, I don't know if I mentioned this before about what you do, is that you're not just a mountain biker. You're also a yoga instructor. Like you have taken the time to educate yourself in movement skills off of the bike. And to me, I think that's what gives you such a unique insight and makes you really better than just about anybody else out there, is you're the only person I know that combines the high level of practical skill that you have with the level of knowledge that you have of the body off of the bike. And so that really helps you explain stuff. So, yeah, man, why don't you just kind of explain a little bit about, for people that don't know, that you're also a yoga instructor and very passionate yogi.
Sure.
Just talk a little bit about the yoga and how you kind of help that feel or feels it helps you and stuff.
Yeah, totally. I mean, oh man, it's like, it's been yoga. I mean, the practice of yoga has been huge for my career. I've been doing it as a necessity, really, for, you know, as a pro rider, having generally a longer pro career than most, yoga was definitely a big part of helping me to continue riding at a high level. And in terms of teaching, it's been really, really, so, you know, you've been a teacher and a coach and a fitness trainer and a strength trainer, for a long time. And when you teach, and that's why I love teaching yoga, in order to teach in an effective way, you've got to be so in tune with everything that's happening in your body. So you develop this ability to observe yourself such that you can provide really accurate cues to the people that are taking your class. And that is, and that just beget it just gets more intimate and more subtle and more nuanced, and it's like the discovery process. I mean, that's part of why I love teaching yoga, and I still do today. It's like it's magical when you kind of get to that kind of place. Like there's always something new to discover, in how your body is moving and some of the limiting habits or patterns that may not be useful for the long term. You know, in yoga, I noticed that with my upward dogs. Like I was just doing it in a kind of a lazy kind of way, and putting a lot of strain on my lumbar. Definitely a little bit of pinching going on. I wasn't spreading out the load. I wasn't connecting from the top of my toes on the mat and creating that tension from the toes right up through the entire length of my body. And so, you know, those kinds of things start to become more aware, you become more aware of as you practice longer and you teach longer. So that's been a big, I've been able to translate that really nicely to the bike, and my coaching on the bike. So
Yeah, no, that's great, man. I think that's exactly kind of what you're speaking to is having a movement practice that allows you the chance to really listen to your body and get in tune and pick apart details. Like, you know, it's funny, I tell people with, you know, the fitness world, I'm sure you run into this in the yoga world as well, where people think they want variety. They want a bunch of new stuff. And as soon as they've learned something new and the shiny newness is worn off, they want something else new. And it's like, you know, I tell people, like, man, when you're bored with something, that's when the real learning begins. Like, mm-hmm. you know, when that shiny newness is worn off and now it's like, okay, now what am I going to do? And like you're talking about, like, you know, after, okay, once you've learned
that
your dog, it's like, well, now it's my mind going to, you know, my body and figuring out, like, where am I not holding tension or where is something not feeling right? And really gaining that body awareness that allows you to move better. Cause really, I think one of the things I try to explain to people all the time is, like, technical skills on your bike are just movement skills being applied to the bike. Like, you're just using basic human movement skills and you're applying them to the bike. And so if you can't move properly off of the bike and you have no body awareness off of the bike, you're not going to find it on the bike. There's just way too much going on for your brain to learn body awareness and movement skills on the bike. So, but again,
right.
I think,
yeah.
like I said, that's one of the reasons I think that what you do is so great, because you have that both sides of it. And so when I hear you teaching skills and I hear you talking, I hear that coming through in you explaining to people how this should feel from this movement standpoint instead of how it should just look. And
right. Yeah, totally. No, that's exactly it. And that's part of the nuanced way of coaching. And that's one of the, for mountain biking, it's, you know, once you do get on the bike and you are working on skills, like, ideally you've got some sort of movement practice off the bike. But when you're on the bike and you're getting a coaching cue, if you're getting a coaching cue from someone, if a coach is telling you, okay, do this, then you're just doing that without the sort of that self-reflective sort of body awareness needed to actually notice what is going on. So it's often, if there's a way to say, okay, try this and let me know what's going on for you. Let me know how it affects your performance. Let me know how it affects this skill. And so you're pointing to something to try, you know, experiment with this different weight shift or this different, move, and let me know what happens. And it kind of forces that awareness, that self-awareness, that curiosity needed to actually understand what's going on.
Yeah. No, it's it's a feedback loop. It's move. How did that feel? If it felt good, do it again. If it didn't feel right, make a correction. Move. How did that? It's like, you know,
over and over. Yeah.
And when you watch someone such as, you know, like when people watch me lift or they watch you ride, sometimes they don't appreciate that we're doing that. It's just that we've been doing it for so long that we're able to process it so quickly that it may not appear from the outside that we're taking that time to think on that level. And when people are first starting out, they're going to have to slow down. They're going to have to be very conscious and very deliberate with this conscious way of learning and moving. And they can't just move as fast as they see someone who's been doing it for a long time doing it. I mean, is that something you'd agree with?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
That's the dangerous part about, mountain bike. It's this tricky part about mountain bike coaching for sure.
Yeah. No, that's it, man. I tell people in the gym, like, I always try to get them to focus on how things feel. Like, I try to use coaching cues. Again, a lot of people don't realize there's actually a science behind coaching cues. Like people have studied this, you know, internal versus external cues.
Oh, yeah.
Process versus results, or outcome. cues and stuff like that. And if you don't understand the difference and you're coaching someone, you might be messing them up unknowingly because you don't understand what the cues that you're giving them are doing to them or like the mental effect they're having. But, you know, using internal cues that get people to focus on how they feel and that are focused on the process, not just the outcome. You know, I tell people if it feels right, it'll look right. If you're just trying to make it look right and not focus on how it feels, I don't know what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
So it's for sure, man. It's that mindfulness in your movement practice that and kind of like goes back, I think, almost way back where we were talking. You're saying like finding that balance with being an online coach between giving people information online and then encouraging them to get out and actually do it. And
yeah.
I think that's one of the things that people struggle with, especially in today's like information rich society, is they think that they can intellectually learn this stuff. You know, if I watch enough videos,
yeah,
enough, and I talk to enough people, I'll intellectually learn how to corner my mountain bike. And it's like,
you
just got to go out there and feel it. And
yeah,
you know, things you can only learn through feel and repetition and stuff. And so yeah, man, no, that's a big part of it. I think that people need to spend more time with is the movement practice that helps them be more mindful so they can apply that to the bike for sure. So,
absolutely. And the cool thing is that inherent in taking a more mindful, curious, experimental, approach to learning, to whether it's, movement practice, whether it's, you know, jiu-jitsu or yoga or whether it's skill practice on the bike, being curious and mindful is inherently satisfying and enjoyable. And you know, that's where it's not about the destination. It's about the journey. I mean, that's really what it's all about. It's being present and mindful in the process. And if you're in that state, then you're learning. If you're so focused on the end result, then it's going to be a struggle and it's probably not going to be enjoyable.
No, man, it's not for sure. Yeah. The embracing the process, man, that's what I, you know, again, another thing I try to get people to, especially new people to riding, like, you know, I know people probably get sick of hearing me say this, but I wish, one of the things I love about jiu-jitsu that I wish we would do with new mountain bikers is just put an arm around them, take them to the side and say, look, you're going to suck ass for about a year or two. Just relax. Just relax. Have fun. Be comfortable with the fact that you are going to suck compared to everyone else who's out here and been riding for a few years, but it's going to get better. And you know what I mean? It just takes so much pressure off of people, I think, to allow them to enjoy the journey and embrace the journey, because we don't do a good enough job of telling people to just embrace the journey. I mean, you know, in jiu-jitsu walking on, they tell you day one, it's going to be 10 years before you're even close to getting a black belt, like 10 years before you're considered an expert at what you're doing here. So just relax. And same thing with mountain biking, man. It's, you know, it takes people 10 years to get to the point where they can ride like the people they're seeing who've been riding for 10 years. And, you know, sometimes they forget that. So. But
I agree, that would be a useful process to initiate new riders with a nice kind of ritual. And that's, you know, in martial arts they've got a lot of ritual like that. And one of the cool things, I think, you know, it's quite a distinction, is that in martial arts, you're, no matter what belt level you're at, once you've learned something, then part of the requirement is that you're required to teach that to the person who hasn't learned it. And that process can start pretty quick. And that again, kind of like what I was saying with teaching yoga and being a coach, is that it forces that self-reflective process. It forces you to sort of, pay attention to your body, so then you can translate what's going on with your body to the next person. And so it kind of, you have to often do it a few times to find the right way and words to describe what's going on. And in that process, you usually refine your own abilities. And so, you know, I think I was just kind of thinking out loud here. I think I'm kind of doing that with the ambassador program I have for my coaching site, but I think that would probably be an even more useful thing to encourage a little bit more, is that, okay, if you've learned something, then yeah, why not take a shot at teaching someone who hasn't? And
yeah.
And through that process, it will improve your own riding ability. And martial arts has that. Such a big part of it, right?
Yeah, no, it is. It's funny. People ask me, they're like, oh, do you coach? And I laugh and I'm like, well, if you show up long enough, eventually you're going to know more than someone else. And
right.
You're going to find yourself showing that someone else something. So yeah, eventually everyone who does martial arts at one point coaches on some level. And I do think that it does help, because you're absolutely right, man. I find that coaching helps you understand things so much better, because you're forced to understand them and put them into words that someone else can then understand and apply. And it forces you to learn it and etch it into your brain deeper. So yeah, very effective. There's actually I've got a blog post on it, on the three types of riders you need in your life. And it was adapted from a quote from Frank Shamrock, who is a pretty famous MMA fighter. And he's in his book, he was, saying you need three kinds of people in your life to make you the best that you can be. And he was talking about, you know, fighting. He's like, you need someone better than you to show you what's possible. You need someone the same as you to, you know, go with you through the journey. And you need someone worse than you that you're able to teach things to and bring along. And if you have those three people or types of people in your life, then you'll do well. And man, when I read that, I was like, see, that's mountain biking right there. It's like, you know, you need those guys. Like for me, you were always one of those guys, man. Like watching you, you know, in the crank videos and all that was like, that's possible, you know, like that's fucking cool. That's possible, putting in my head. And then, you know, but having my riding buddies, the guy that, you know, that like in the least egotistical way that like, if he can do it, I can do it, you know,
mm-hmm.
So vice versa, you know, so you're kind of pushing each other a little bit that way. And then, you know, lastly,
cool.
Rider that you're taking out and you're showing things to, and it's like, you know, that's what, you know, the mountain biking, you know, a good mountain biking life would include, I think. So yeah
that's cool, man. Yeah, I love that. I think that's spot on. And I just, you know, it kind of reminds me of kind of a bit I've struggled with this bit of advice that I've read in so many different sort of books, performance books, and it's not so much foreign sports, but just in general, it's like, you got to hang out, you got to make sure the people in your life are people that you aspire to be, and get rid of and not hang out with the people that bring you down or are, you know, not where you want to be. And I always kind of struggled with that. I was like, well, that seems kind of, for one, kind of ethically not so so right, didn't feel right. And it's like what you said, the balance of have like being like, yeah, find someone that's better than you that you can be inspired by, but you know, in all these different aspects of life, make sure that there's also people in your life that you can share and pass along knowledge to as well, that may be in a different place or hard place or bad place in their life. Don't eliminate them from your life because they've got negative energy going on around them, or whatever it is. Like, it doesn't seem right to, you know, do you know that bit of feedback? Have you read that? Like,
I have, yeah. And I think that, I know exactly what you're saying, because I've kind of like wondered the same thing myself. But I think really what, you know, you got to remember, like, guys like you and me, like, we're, you know, again, not trying to sound like all big head or anything, we're a little bit ahead of the curve when it comes to some of these ideas. And so we're looking
Right.
at a little bit different place. Like there's people that are still hanging out with their high school friends. You know what I mean? Who are just like living in a mom's basement, playing video games, doing nothing,
Just
and
kind of stuck in a,
thought,
yeah.
yeah, you're just hanging out with the same people every day. They're going nowhere. And versus like us, like I think we try to have like a little bit more dynamic relationships and consciously create our lives on a little bit bigger scale. So having people in your life that I mean, I'll just say, they don't listen to this podcast. I'm not gonna name names, but I got a couple family members that if you wanted to be like totally technical about like, oh, they're negative and blah, blah, blah. It's like, a lot of times when I talk to them, it's like, they got something wrong going on. They're not always the most positive people, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, I can't just get rid of everyone in my life who's contributed and so yeah, I know what you mean, but I think it's more being rich to that dude who's still hanging out with his high school buddies, playing video games in the basement at 26 years old. It's like, maybe you need to get some new friends, brother. Find some mountain bikers.
That's cool. Yeah, mountain bikers, it's a pretty cool crew of people. It's great. General, it's hard to meet a mountain biker that doesn't have some cool things kind of going on, or just fun to be around and hang out with.
Yeah, I mean, besides the fact that mountain bikes cost like freaking as much as a car, so you kind of have to have something going on some level just to afford a damn bike. But yeah, no, mountain bikers, I agree, man. We do tend to be a little bit more driven and not as averse to risk, and those things that tend to make a little bit more successful people in life. So yeah, for sure, man. Well, hey, I know I don't want to keep you too long. I know we've been talking here for almost an hour, but before we wrap this up, man, I want to talk about the 12 ride flat pedal challenge and just let people know who don't know about it yet, what it is, where they can find out about it, and just yeah, just kind of had a couple questions for you on it. But real quick, why don't you just let people know what it is, man?
Yeah, well, as you know, it's been a shared passion of both of ours to encourage riders to log a serious amount of time on flat pedals. And I decided that 12 rides is pretty much the absolute minimum needed to experience the benefits of flat for riders who have pretty much spent their whole mountain biking career on clipless. So this program, it's this free online course that's on my site, is basically providing all the information you need to make that transition, and also providing drills and challenges throughout each of the rides, things to focus on each of the rides, kind of like what we were talking before, such that you become capable of riding with flats. And not only that, but have the opportunity to improve your skill set in a way that really only riding with flats can provide. It's sort of, riding with flat pedals forces you to move your body in the most effective and efficient way for executing pretty much all technical riding skills. And so, that's the idea of the challenge. And also, James, thanks for contributing to it too. You had a great video, with some cool, off bike movement drills. And on that page, is your flat pedal manifesto that's available for download too, which is, just a fantastic bit of research. So,
Oh, thanks, man. No, yeah, thanks for allowing me to contribute, man. I'm glad I could help. And yeah, the 12 rides, it's funny, I was gonna ask you, but did the number 12 just kind of pop into your head? Or 'cause I kind of found that too. But it also, for most riders, like if you're riding 3 times a week, 12 rides is gonna be about a month. you know? And so somewhere that like, you know, I would tell people like 4 to 6 weeks, which would also roughly translate into about 12 rides. And so it's kind of interesting that you and I have both found the exact same kind of number, is that number that people need to commit to. So, so what are some of the biggest lessons? I mean, people have been doing it for a while now, and you know, people have definitely been very vocal, looks like, with their feedback and stuff. So, I guess, what are some of the biggest lessons that people have been sharing from, you know, going through the 12 ride, flat pedal challenge?
Well, it is pretty cool, you know, especially on, say for instance, like, you know, their Strava times, like, even just for climbing, which is kind of the big one in terms of, oh no, I don't want to go to flats because all my uphill Strava times will be blown. And, people are realizing that, that's not happening. You know, they're still maintaining their efficiency even with flats. So, you know, it's hard to argue with that. Same thing, you know, for riders that have been logging longer amounts of time and they're getting technically proficient. You know, they're starting to increase some of their downhill Strava times. Just, you know, just because they've, you know, again, it's not the, you know, someone wrote, I did a post online. Well, just look at all the downhill racers. You know, they're all using clipless pedals. You know, that's got to be the best way to
Oh,
go.
don't
But
get me
it's like,
started on that, dude. That seems dangerous,
what?
man. I
And
read the rest of this. He's the guy who's like got some young rider on. That dude's dangerous. But anyways, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I know. So anyway, it's like, every one of those downhill racers has logged serious time on flat pedals. Any one of them could switch to flats and rock it. You know, and they do. If it's a muddy race, then they'll switch to flats and they'll have no problem. So anyway,
I
just
mean, G.
going on a
G. Atherton
tangent.
did that, what, like a year or two ago? G. Atherton did that and had borrowed shoes. He had to borrow somebody's 510s. I don't know if he had his own flats or whatever, but ended up winning, you know, the World Cup downhill race on borrowed flat pedals and shoes. So, you know, it just speaks to what you're saying. Like, all of these guys have mad flat pedal skills. That's one of the things I've also observed too, is like, you know, for the pros, clipless pedals will give them a couple percentage points increase in performance. For your average rider, we're talking like 50, 60, like their entire performance is tied up in their pedals. And that's not the same thing. And, you know, it's that, so anyways, that's for me, you know, that the big mark for me is if you get off of clipless pedals and, you know, you see more than like a, you know, 5-10% decrease in performance, that's a sign that you were just using bad technique and bad, you weren't very efficient with how you were moving on the bike and stuff. And so,
Yeah, it's an opportunity. Boom. That just tells you you've got a huge opportunity for improvement.
But man,
So.
that just speaks to, you know what, man, this is something too, like, you can speak to this, man, is the ego, right? Like, so this is, you probably find this, is that people get busy trying to protect their ego rather than getting curious and trying to learn and grow from that experience. Is that something you've seen too? Like, people have their feet fly off the pedals the first time and they're like, fuck this, I'm going back to clipless, instead of like, whoa, well, this is curious. Why is this? Why, this is an opportunity for me to grow.
Exactly. And that's, I explicitly mentioned that in the course as well, is that, your skill level is going to decrease when you make the switch, and it's going to take some time for the new movement patterns to be established. And so, yeah, ego is a big part, but also just the cultural sort of momentum in our mountain bike culture is clipless equates to high performance. And so yes, in some cases it does, but you know, like we said, for downhill racing at the high level, there might be a few situations where the clipless pedals are enabling the rider to to go faster. And same with cross country, especially like, you know, when you're tired and you're just trying to keep mashing the pedals over rough terrain, you'll be able to save a little bit of energy. But that's different than learning. It's a totally different thing. So, just a tangent there, but, the cultural momentum is get on Quotas as fast as possible, which is not helping, it's not helping riders gain confidence in their riding. So.
No, man, not at all. It's not helping our sport. I mean, unfortunately, that's where like the whole flat pedal revolution manifesto, like the point of it isn't, you know, people confuse being pro flats with being anti clipless. They're not
right.
The same thing,
that's the
right?
Dangerous. That's what it's. Yeah.
So, because that's what that guy's point, you know what I mean? Like, that's the reason the guy starts bringing up, like, oh, you know, instead of like answering to the points that you're making about flats, they start defending clipless pedals. And it's like, wait a minute, that's not what I'm talking about, right? Like, you're not addressing what I'm saying about flats here. And so the big problem that I personally have with the mountain bike industry is that clipless pedals are still pushed on riders based on what really are myths and lies. Like, the need to pull up on the backstroke is a lie. It has been disproven. It has been shown, you know, that that's not how to pedal the bike. The idea that you need to be on the ball of the foot.
You know, it must be a totally, you know, even so so my history, I started cross country, like my mountain biking career started with cross country racing. And I remember switching to clipless as fast as possible. And I did. And I remember training cross country and working on this awesome pedal stroke where I pulled up with the clip. I got clipless down. Now I can pull up. And I remember it just feeling so awkward. And I'd do it because I'd just be intentional and do it. And then I just would fall out of it and stop. And it just didn't, it seemed like, almost felt like more effort or less efficient in a way when I was trying to do that. And you probably know the science more behind the pedaling efficiency. I haven't looked as much into the pedaling efficiency world as you have, but all I remember is just that that stark sort of, I couldn't figure out how to get used to this tug up on my backstroke, you know?
No, totally, man. It's very, and again, there's a couple studies that have shown that when you pull up on the backstroke, you produce less power and you burn more energy to do it. It is absolutely the wrong way to pedal your bike, because you're overriding your body's natural way of moving, which is to focus on a strong downward push and have a more passive pull, basically to reset your leg for a strong downward push. And that's how our bodies are made to move. And so, yeah, but again, like, the science is there. This is the thing that drives me nuts is, like, you know, I was listening to the Joe Rogan podcast the other day, and he was interviewing Gary Taub, the guy who wrote The Case Against Sugar. And he was talking about what makes good science versus bad science. And, you know, and he was just pointing out that realistically, like, 95% of scientists out there are not doing good science, that a lot of science is driven by, you know, the need to get grants. And so you kind of got to, you know, toe the line and publish things that are acceptable to get the money for it. But one of the things that he pointed out, two things that really like jumped out at me, he said that he once heard science be defined as a beautiful theory destroyed by an ugly fact. And that is like kind of where the pedal stroke is we had this beautiful theory about pushing and pulling and ankling and all of this beautiful theory on how to power the lower body. And then when they studied it, that's not what they found. And now here are ugly facts staring them in the face. And the cycling industry, instead of dealing with these facts, you know, starts to ignore them, which brings me to my second point, which is, you know, bad science, which is science is driven by what is called the anomalous observation. It is that study that doesn't come out the way that you thought that it would, that's anomalous, that anomaly. that's where people get curious, because that's where the new discoveries and the new frontiers lie. You know, bad scientists are busy looking for things that just confirm what they think they already know. Good scientists are looking for those anomalous observations. We have several anomalous observations in the pedal stroke science. Mm-hmm. And again, instead of getting curious, you get people who just defend the clipless pedal viewpoint of, you know, the old school viewpoint. I call it basically flat earth theory. Like at this point, if you're telling someone to pull up on the backstroke and to push through the ball of their foot and use the ankling technique, you're basically preaching flat earth theory. Like you're using the same amount of science that the flat earthers are using, and in the face of the same amount of science that says that what you're saying is wrong. So, you know, it's, there you go.
No. That's a great rant, man. Like spot on. I fully agree. And it's not only does that, should that, trigger curiosity, but also excitement. It's like, wow, you know, this is rad. What a cool discovery. This is like, this opens up a whole new world of opportunity.
And
you know, that's what flat pedals are. It's a huge opportunity for so many mountain bikers to not only improve their technique, but to feel safer, to improve their confidence, to have more comfort during their rides. And so it's like, and that's what I mean, that's really the desire for the flat pedal challenge. And also I went through it too. Like I said, I started with clipless pedals. I started riding and practicing trials with clipless pedals. And, you know, in during that process, I noticed some of the top level riders from around the world doing trials were on flats. I'm like, what? No way is that possible. And, I learned the wheelie the hard way, and I fell to my ass on concrete a bunch of times trying to learn how to wheelie with clipless pedals. It sucked. And so I've been on that side, and when I switched to flats for trials, I sucked. My skills were terrible. I was like, this can't be the way to go. But I stuck with it and soon enough I was having all these incredible discoveries, just these new movement pattern relationships with a bike that I realized were necessary, just this efficient way to move my body on my bike was enabling my skill level to just start to, like, it just blasted past where I was at with the clipless pedals. And I mean, that was the start of my trials career. And that's how that decision enabled me, really, that crucial decision to switch to flats was what helped me, you know, make a living for the last 25 years.
Yeah, man, and inspire freaking, you know, generations of riders, bro. I mean, yeah, it's I'm glad you made that switch for sure. God, I still remember, man, watching it. It was Crank 3, I think, man. You're fucking hopping from log to log, and I'm like, it was one of those moments. I'm like, he can do that. That looks so cool. I want to do that.
Cool.
One of these days, I'll have to send you my my pictures, man. I have a blog post on it's called Pallet City, and I built this whole skinny network and teeter totters, and it was all connected to pallets when I was living in Hawaii and had them out in this field, and we would just go out there and just session for days, man. But like honestly, it was that, like, yeah, watching you, man, on riding those logs and stuff, it just looked like so much fun. And I was I want to learn how to do that. So, be honest with you, without Ryan Leese, I wouldn't be the same rider, you know? I probably would have gotten sucked in down a different road. But,
crazy.
I just thought that's how you rode. So,
we go way back then, yeah.
We do, man. You don't even know it, man. But, yeah, you definitely had an influence on me for quite a while. So, which is what makes it even cooler that we're able to, like, you know, talk like this now and, share some knowledge and stuff. So it's great. But, yeah, man. Well, I guess before I let you go, one last thing I do want to point out about the flat pedal thing that I've talked with other people about. Flat pedals will also increase the accessibility to our sport. Like if you want to get more women, you want to get more kids and stuff involved in our sport, and if we can get out of this insane, you have to get on clipless pedals as quickly as possible, and people knew that they could come in and just ride flat pedals, the industry would be shocked. If they could just get out of their own way, the next growth stage of this sport would hit it. But as long as outsiders looking at our sport think that they're going to have to get on clipless pedals and they're rightfully scared of doing that, they're not even going to try our sport. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've had multiple conversations with people who, once I explained to them, no, you don't need to be on clipless pedals, you could do flats, like, their whole attitude towards trying mountain biking changed.
Yeah, it softens and it just feels, yeah, more welcoming and possible. Yeah. No, I've experienced the same thing.
Yeah. Cool, man.
No, I'm on, we're preaching the same tune, man.
Yeah, it's been cool. I've actually noticed, like, there's definitely a movement among women riders, a lot more of them using flats, and
I
know at the women's skills camps, a lot of them are encouraging them to use flats, so it's good. They're kind of taking on themselves, but I think as an industry we could do a better job supporting that message if we could just get with the times, people. Stop telling
people. Yeah, kind of from the top down, that's kind of what you're speaking to.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah, man. I mean, you're one of the few people, I got to hand it to you, man. Like, you are one of the few people in the industry that I've talked to who will actually come on record with these views on flat pedals. Like, I have had shocking conversations with people, in the mountain bike industry, and their basic attitude is they know that clipless pedals are a problem. They know that they're overrated, but they're just going to piss people off if they say something, and it's not going to make any difference, a.k.a. they're going to start losing sponsors or advertising dollars and at the end of the day, they don't think it's going to actually do anything, and it's like, that's not cool.
It's a good point you make. I think you're right in terms of there is huge benefit overall to the cycling industry to embrace and encourage and support flat pedal use for the majority of riders, and that will enable a growth and sort of an uptake in newcomers to the sport for sure. I mean, it's definitely, there's a relation there to have when there's a conflicted message, when there's an intuitive sort of sense that, oh, something doesn't seem right, which people pick up on, that creates a negative sort of a negative ambiance, and we don't want that. So
no, we got a great sport. I want more people doing it, and I think that it's easier to get them to do it on flats, because but anyways, well, cool, man. Hey, I appreciate your time. We definitely have to get together and have another one. We always have great conversations. I had like another list of stuff I was going to talk to you about that I got to.
I know.
Good talk there. But I guess before I let you go, let people know where they can find your website, where they can find you, and they want to find out more.
Check out learn.ryanleach.com, and you can find out all about all my offerings there, all my coaching, and some of the free stuff, flat pedal challenge, if you haven't checked that out, for sure. If you're already on that plan, which I think a lot of people are, then definitely I'd love for you to check out what I'm up to, what's going on. So, and yeah. James, man, I always enjoy these conversations, so thanks for having me on your podcast again.
Oh, hell yeah, man, people love these things. It's just a great excuse to talk to you. So, but yeah, like I was, saying for the podcast, man, I really want to encourage people to check out your site. I think that what you're doing with the skills training stuff is really the best of what's going on out there. And I think that your unique perspective, both from being such a high-end user and also your ability to, translate those things into how things should feel and move off of the bike from your yoga practice, just put you in a really unique position. And So if people are interested in improving their skills and they're looking at like an online resource, definitely highly recommend it. But you know, even if you're going to go to a camp or something with somebody else live, like still a great resource because Ryan will definitely give you some different perspectives and some different ways to look at it that might just, you know, just to help enhance it. So can't encourage you guys to check out what he's doing enough. But yeah, but definitely appreciate you taking the time to share some knowledge and also just like I said, man, taking the time to put that site together and share all of your experience with people around the world so we can get better as well.
Brad, well, I really appreciate that, James, and I really appreciate everything you do.
Thanks, cool, man. We're right on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to hit stop on this podcast, and we'll call it quits on this one. We'll definitely do another one soon. So once again, guys, thanks for joining us for another Bike James podcast. You can check me out at bikejames.com, and we'll talk to you guys later.
Right on.